If you would like to follow along this morning, we're going to start our lesson in the book of Numbers, the 25th chapter. Numbers 25. And the thoughts I have put together this morning are lessons that we can learn from obscure characters of the Bible. And for the most part, Christians are relatively obscure people. And sometimes we doubt that we have the capability of doing anything that's going to impact anybody right outside our immediate circle. But I want to look at these people whose names are hardly known, if known at all, and the things that they did and the impact that it had to encourage us to never take any service to God lightly. In chapter 25 of Numbers, starting in verse 1, we read, "While Israel was staying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with the Moabite women, who invited them to the sacrifices of their gods. The people ate the sacrificial meal and bowed down before these gods. So Israel yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger burned against them. The Lord said to Moses, 'Take all the leaders of these people, kill them, and expose them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the Lord's fierce anger may turn away from Israel.' So Moses said to Israel's judges, 'Each of you must be put to death those of your people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor.' Then an Israelite man brought into the camp a Midianite woman right before the eyes of Moses and the whole assembly of Israel while they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he left the assembly, took a spear in his hand, and followed the Israelite into the tent. He drove the spear into both them, ripped right through the Israelite man and into the woman's stomach. Then the plague against the Israelites was stopped, but those that died in the plague numbered 24,000. The Lord said to Moses, 'Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned my anger away from the Israelites. Since he was zealous for my honor among them, I did not put an end to them in my zeal. Therefore, tell him I am making a covenant of peace with him. He and his descendants will have a covenant of lasting priesthood because he was zealous for the honor of his God and made atonement for the Israelites. The name of the Israelite who was killed with the Moabite woman was Zimri, son of Salu, and the leader of a Simeonite family. The name of the Midianite woman who was put to death was Cosbi, daughter of Zur, a tribal chief of the Midianites." Everybody knows who Phinehas is. We're not going to talk about Phinehas, but just briefly. But I want to look at the two that were killed, Zimri and Cosbi. Now, if you were to be asked, who is Zimri and Cosbi, I dare say that most of us would have no idea. But even though these two weren't ground zero of the sin that brought God's wrath upon Israel, they were symptoms of the disease. And it was through their death that the plague was stopped. God's mercy came forward. He walked straight through the camp. You've got people dying. You've got people being killed for their sin. You've got people weeping at the gates of the tabernacle because they are so terrified of what's happening, that they're so remorseful for the sin that's in their camp. And he blatantly takes a woman and continues on in this immoral act right in the presence of everyone. He has no concern about his neighbors that are dying. He has no concern about his family that are dying. He has no concern about the wrath of God. And yet Phinehas takes it upon himself to deal with the matter. We need to understand that even though these two were not the primary cause or the start of this plague, they were a symptom. We often think that our sin affects no one but ourselves. And we couldn't be further from the truth. Look at David, king of Israel. He thought his tryst with Bathsheba would just be a night of passion and no one would be harmed by it. But look at the results. A loyal husband and soldier, faithful soldier, was murdered as a result of this. An innocent child died. David was punished with a family that was so dysfunctional that they resorted to rape, to murder, to incest, to rebellion, even seeking to take the life of King David. Sin is a cancer. If it's not stopped, it's spread throughout the whole body, and it will consume not only us, but the ones that we care about as well. Now, I can't leave this without briefly mentioning the action of Phinehas. If not for his zeal, there's absolutely no way we could ever know how many Israelites might have been killed before God stopped this plague against them. And I think sometimes the human side of us, we look at the tragic loss of sudden death, especially in large numbers, and think how horrible it is. But when we die in our sins, the tragedy has only just begun. Sin affects everyone around it. I think the lesson we can learn from Phinehas here is that sometimes as a Christian, as a servant of the Lord, we're called upon to make a difficult decision. Now, I'm not suggesting that we pick up a weapon and go to kill an evildoer, although there is some appeal to that idea. That's not the point we're making here. But there are things that we have to do that we would rather not. The price of Christianity comes high. Oftentimes it may cost us a really good paying dream job that compromises our integrity and our honesty. It may even cost us the loss of our lifelong childhood friend if their lifestyle is a danger to us or our family. Sometimes it brings a sword into a family and severs ties with those that we love the most. Sin is not to be taken lightly. It has a far-reaching effect. And the things that we do, even in private, affect those all around us. I'm going to read now from the book of 2 Kings in chapter 5. I want to talk about a man whose name is not even known. The Bible doesn't record his name, but what he does is of major importance, and a major lesson can be learned from it. In chapter 5 of 2 Kings, verse 9, we read, "So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him to say, 'Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed.' But Naaman went away angry, and he said, 'I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, to wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the water in Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?' So he turned and went away in a rage. And one of Naaman's servants went to him and said, 'My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?' So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy." Here we've got a man that he knows what he needs to do. He's been given instructions of how to relieve himself of this horrible disease, but he's mad. He's not mad because he didn't get what he asked for, and even though it was the simplest of solutions, but he wanted something grandiose. When the servant spoke to him, he realized, "I've got the answer right here in my hand." So he obeyed. This is a lesson that we need to learn as well. We need to be the calm voice of reason whenever a situation is becoming volatile. When there's anger involved, when there's pride involved, we need to be the voice that quietly says, "Why not do the right thing?" Or sometimes we need to take a lesson from the friends of Job and just keep our mouth shut, to sit down with someone that is grieving, that is angry, and let them know that we care with our silence. And above all, we need to pray for discernment so that we might know when to say the right thing and what to say. There's another character that's mentioned in the Bible by the name of Hothach. Now, once again, a very obscure fella, but Hothach is a eunuch. And he's assigned to the king, and the king says, "I want you to be of service to Queen Esther." So, in Esther chapter 4, Esther's cousin Mordecai has the word has been brought to her that he's grieving, he's in sackcloth and ashes, he won't eat, something is wrong. So she sends Hathach with a message to find out what is the matter. And in verse 5, we read, Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city, in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and explain to her. And he told him to instruct her to go to the king's presence and beg for mercy and to plead with the people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. And then she instructed him to go back and say to Mordecai, and I'm not going to read any further, because he carries several messages back and forth between Esther and Mordecai as they plot out what they can do to save their people. Now the lesson we learn here is that loyalty is a very noble quality regardless of your status in life. If he had not been a man of integrity and loyal to the queen, he could have taken the information that he was hearing and gone to the king and told the king, said, your queen and this peasant are trying to undermine your direct commands and your edicts. But he wasn't. It would have ended badly for everybody involved if that had happened. Instead, thousands of Jews were spared because of this man's loyalty to his queen. Now, had he decided to go to the king, there's no doubt that God would have found another route to save the people, but he didn't have to, because here was a man that was a faithful servant. When we're loyal and we're obedient, we may never see a history-changing event as a result, but being a trustworthy friend counts. Being a good, loyal employee counts. Being a good citizen can change the course of someone's life, or maybe even several someone's. I'm sure that Hathach had no concept of the magnitude of these messages that he was transferring to and fro, but he was a man of integrity, and he helped save the day. We may not see the small acts of obedience that we're called on to do, the impact that they might make. We simply do them because it's our master's will, and because if it never leads to anything other than pleasing God with our service, then that is the most important thing that we can do. I'm going to read now from Jeremiah, the 35th chapter. And I want to talk about a man by the name of Jehonadab. Now, if someone asks you in a Bible class, who's Jehonadab? We go, I've heard the name. He's that fellow that, then we realize we don't know who he is. Very obscure. He's mentioned a couple of times in the Bible is all. Beginning in verse 1 of Jeremiah 35, we read, and this is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord during the reign of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah. Go to the Rechabite family and invite them to come to one of the side rooms of the house of the Lord and give them wine to drink. So I went to Jezaniah, son of Jeremiah, the son of Habazaniah, and all his brothers and his sons, the whole family of the Rechabites. And I brought them into the house of the Lord, into the room of the sons of Hanan, a man of God. It was next to the room of the officials, which was over that of Messiah, the son of Shalom, the doorkeeper. Then I set bowls full of wine and some cups before the Rechabites, and I said to them, drink some wine. But they replied, we do not drink wine, because our forefather Jehonadab, son of Rehab, gave us this command. Neither you nor your descendants must ever drink wine. Also, you must never build houses, sow seeds, or plant vineyards. You must never have any of these things, but must always live in tents. Then you will live a long time in a land where you're nomads. We have obeyed everything that our forefather Jehonadab son of Rechab commanded us. Neither we, nor our wives, nor our sons, nor daughters have ever drunk wine, or built houses to live in, or had vineyards, or fields, or crops. We have lived in tents and have fully obeyed everything our forefather Jehonadab commanded us. Jehonadab is first introduced to us as he's traveling down the road and he meets Jehu, has been appointed as king of the northern kingdom. And Jehu stops his chariot and says, "Are you and I in agreement? Is your heart like my heart?" And Jehonadab says, "It is." Then Jehu invites him into the chariot, and they go about plotting the downfall of all the prophets of Baal, trying to wipe out idolatry in the land of Israel. We see his zeal here for the Lord, and that he's willing to take on this mission. But even more so, we see the influence that this man had on his entire family. He recognized the dangers and the influence that can pull us away from the Lord. He commanded his family, "Don't drink wine. Don't strive for riches. Don't associate with those that might steer you away from the Lord." You know, that's pretty good advice, even today. In fact, here we are today, some 26 years after this, and I've read reports that says there's still a group of nomadic people that call themselves the Rechabites, and they follow these same teachings. At the time Jeremiah offers the wine to them, it's been 200 years, 250 years actually, since Jehonadab. And the lesson here for us is very simple. Lead by example. The faith that we portray will have an influence on the generations to come. Really simple. Our family sees what we do. Our children see what we do. Our neighbors see what we do. And it has an impact. And lastly, I want to read two verses about a man. I'm sure maybe the kids could tell me who he is because they've memorized all the judges. But he's a man by the name of Tola. In Judges 1 and 2, we read, "After the time of Abimelech, a man of Issachar named Tola, son of Puah, rose to save Israel. He lived in Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim, and he led Israel 23 years, and he died and was buried in Shamir." That's not much of a tribute to this man. And if we left it at that, with maybe even question, why was this even put in there? But if you, hundreds of years later, if you look at the writings of Josephus, the well-known Jewish historian, he expands on that. He notes that during Tola's administration, it was defined by peace. He emphasizes that Tola was a man of great virtue that kept the nation politically stable after a disastrous and bloody tyranny of Abimelech. Josephus paints him as a healer of the state. Peacemaker. There is no wasted service to God, from the janitor to the renowned gospel preacher, to the quiet calmness, the calm voice of the one that avoids strife. There is absolutely nothing we can do in the service to God that is unimportant if it brings glory to Him and edifies our brethren. I've got a couple of stories I want to regale to you in the last moment. This is told to me to be a true story. It's in the early 1900s of a small country church out in the middle of nowhere before the times of central heating and air, and it was kept warm in the winter by a little wood heater. And it was an old man, an old gentleman. He was a bachelor, lifelong bachelor, and every summer he would cut a load of firewood. And he would let it season, and before winter got there, he would haul it to the church building, stack it in next to the heater. And anytime there was a gospel meeting or Sunday morning or any type of event, he would get there an hour early, light the heater, and when the people showed up, the building would be warm. And he was rather obscure. There was people that attended there that didn't even know the old man's name. He never led a prayer. He never led a song. He never preached a sermon. He wasn't an elder nor a deacon, or of hardly any notice. But then he died one spring day. And a few people attended his funeral. Some didn't even know his name. But in October of that year, it come the blue norther early, dropped the temperature down in the 20s and high teens, and everybody showed up at church that morning, and it was so bitterly cold that they had to cancel services. At that point, they realized what an important function this quiet old man performed for the brethren there. He made sure the building was comfortable, that services could be carried on as normal without any interruption by the weather. And lastly, I want to tell you the story of a man named Jim. Jim was a teenager, he was overweight, he was horribly timid, the shyest man you'd ever want to meet. He would hardly even speak to a stranger to say hi. And when he was 16, one of his schoolmates asked him to come to a gospel meeting. So Jim went. And the preacher that night found fertile ground. Jim went forward and obeyed the gospel. And when he got home, his mother and father asked him how he enjoyed it, and he told them what had happened. Well, it shamed them. You see, they had been members of the church in previous years and had fallen away. And that next Sunday, Jim's mother, his father, him, and his two younger brothers loaded up and went to church. Mother and father was restored. Some years later, the middle brother obeyed the gospel, him and his wife. He had two children that obeyed the gospel. The younger brother, as he got older, him and his wife obeyed the gospel. They had three children that obeyed the gospel. Jim's mother and father taught the neighbors that were friends of theirs, and they obeyed the gospel. And they had two children that obeyed the gospel. One of their sons became a preacher, and his best friend also obeyed the gospel and became a preacher. And there was a brother-in-law and a sister-in-law and two children of theirs that obeyed the gospel. And when the last time I counted, the number was over 20 that had been directly influenced to obeying the gospel or were coming back to the Lord because of a simple act of obedience by a shy, overweight 16-year-old boy. There's no job, there's no act of obedience that goes unnoticed. Now, the first story I told could be urban legend, it could be fiction, I don't know. The second story, I know for a fact it's true, because Jim is my brother. And so it really hits close to home. We need to understand, you don't have to be a powerful gospel preacher. You don't have to be R.J. Stevens. You can simply be the person that comes forward and obeys the Lord to the best of their ability. People notice, and it has an impact. So I encourage all of us today to realize any service that we offer is service well rendered. God sees it, even if no one else does. Would you bow with me now as we close?